Well, thank you all for coming. My name's Erin McPherson. I'm head of video at Yahoo. What that basically means is I oversee our video business across all of our consumer-facing media channels, news, sports, finance, our entertainment channels, and our new video destination, which is Yahoo Screen. And I'm really excited to be here, to be at South by Southwest, and to have the folks that I have with me today on the panel. I'm going to, before I turn it over to them to talk about themselves a little bit, we were all just thinking, you know, we have a number of interesting issues that come up in this new era of digital media and how one effectively tells a story with so many different options as far as screens and platforms. And we're happy to talk about that also because this is a pretty intimate room. We were thinking we could do an extended Q&A and really get a sense of what you guys want us to talk about for once, you know, rather than us take the whole panel and maybe not address what you're interested in, what questions you might have. So we were all just saying perhaps we open this up early and kind of make this truly interactive. So with that, I'm going to hand this over to my panelists just to talk about themselves, briefly introduce themselves, and talk a little bit about, you know, what they do.
And please tweet us your questions only. My name is Mike Rosenstein. I'm a producer at Ben Stiller's company, Red Hour. And I run right now our digital production arm, which basically, you know, is our goal is to continue the quality of comedy and production value that we have in our movies, you know, like Zoolander and Tropic Thunder and Dodgeball, and extend that brand to online and, you know, make digital series and games. And we actually are doing a series with Yahoo. It's going to be distributed on Yahoo Screen called Burning Love. That's sort of a parody of The Bachelor, and it's got a bunch of big people in it, and Ken Marino is the star, and Kristen Bell and Malin Ackerman and Michael Ian Black and Ken Jeong and a ton of people. So we kind of like to bring what we bring to, you know, the movies, and we're also developing TV, but you know, we're trying to extend the brand, so that's it.
My name is Jordan Levin, and I'm CEO of a company called Generate. And Generate was a company we started up about 7 years ago, and the focus was on multi-platform production development, so thinking less about being a TV producer, film producer, digital producer, and just the idea that content is going to travel across screens, and you need to, you know, have the relationships and learn how to manage content across screens. We have a talent management division, and we recently were acquired by Alloy, which is a digital company that has the leading network against 12 to 34-year-olds, so young skewing digital network. Prior to that, I was CEO of the WB Network, so always been sort of interested in younger audiences, whether it's been programming or developing or producing for younger audiences, and definitely saw the WB very early attraction to digital being used as a way to not only extend storytelling but connect the audience more closely with the creators.
Hi, I'm Larry Tans. I'm CEO of Vuguru. We're an independent studio. We develop and we finance scripted content intended for distribution on digital platforms, and we also distribute a lot of our projects internationally. Last year, we financed 7 projects that we shot, and a bunch of them will be coming out this year. We also announced today that we're in business with Yahoo on a number of projects. Our goal is to focus on the storytelling by bringing our own financing to the equation and not having to rely fully on brand and advertising to pay for the content. The company was founded by Michael Eisner, former head of Disney, who's chairman, and we have significant financing from Rogers Media, the biggest cable and wireless company in Canada.
Great. Well, thank you, guys. So I don't know if we go for it with our interactive idea. We can go for it and see if we can go for a whole hour with just you guys. I've got questions too, so I can fill in if people are shy. Do people want to hear anything particular? Should I kick it off and then we can draw from there? Should I kick it off? Mm-hmm. Raise it. Okay, I'll kick it off. I know in Austin, at least, I feel like morning really starts at noon. One of my first questions is something I grapple with at Yahoo as a programmer myself, and that is, this isn't a linear world, and that's amazing for a lot of reasons. And it's also challenging, meaning I think of Jordan talking about the WB, I don't program Tuesday night at 8 o'clock. I don't have that weekly time slot. And how does one think about storytelling and content when, in a film world, you have a release date, you come out with your big movie, it's opening weekend, you have marketing, you have P&A, you build it up, you release your movie. Television, you have a time slot, you market around that. There's a repetitive viewing activity that old audience, I don't mean old, I mean traditional audience goes to. And now in the age of anytime, anywhere, even with television for that matter, and people watching entire series in one sitting, which I know I've done, how does one tell a story? Or is it actually kind of enhancing one's ability to tell a story? I'd love to get your viewpoints on a nonlinear world and a world without needing to be 22 minutes, 44 minutes. You can make something 3 minutes. A lot of our best performing stuff on Yahoo is short. Or you can make something an hour. I mean, I know, Larry, maybe I'll kick off with you. Your programming seems to be able to be viewed in a more immersive, longer experience or an episodic experience. And how does that work?
It's a great question. When Vugaroo first started, the company launched a project called Prom Queen, and there was a firm belief that everybody on the internet had ADD, and if an episode was longer than 90 seconds, nobody would keep watching. And maybe that was true. The series did really, really well. But last summer, we launched a drama called The Booth at the End on Hulu, and 75% of the people who started watching an episode watched the whole thing. Those episodes were half an hour each. And we saw that most people who watched episode 3 would go back and watch episode 1 and 2, and episode 4 would go back, et cetera. So either consumer behavior has changed or the viewing experience has gotten better, where iPads and higher bandwidth enable people to watch something in a much more kind of high-quality experience than 5 years ago, so I think that's part of it. But it's a great question because, I watched 3 seasons of Breaking Bad in 3 weeks on Netflix, and it was an amazing experience, and it was a lot better than waiting over 3 years and watching all the ads and the traditional television experience. So I think on demand, if you eat stuff out over a long period of time and they're 5 minutes long, you're almost punishing the audience who really likes it because you watch 5 minutes and now you have to wait another week to see another 5. So I do believe it's not, as Aaron said, it's not about a big launch and how many views you get in the first week. It's really about getting it out there and getting the word out there, and over time people kind of going and checking it out and going back into the catalog and watching from the beginning. And for me, that's a very valuable, positive experience. But I don't think anyone really knows. I know short-form comedy can work really well in one-off episodes. I think definitely drama or dramatic comedy, it's good to give that long arc. Everything we do is about 90 to 100 minutes in its total arc, but then we have these chapters that are viewable on their own. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think what you said about Breaking Bad is really good. It's the best show. But, on demand, that's what, I mean, most of what we're watching anyways is on demand. As producers, I think, we're still totally figuring it out. But, we're able to make things online that we couldn't make on TV or in movies. We can do different things. And I think we're trusting that the audience is going to come to it. And as a company, I mean, we didn't start a website like Funny or Die. We do stuff with them, but we didn't want to do just one-off videos. We really wanted to tell stories and to do what we do in features and to like make content that's a series. And we actually partnered with Paramount, and we have a first look deal there. And their model is to make series that are those short episodes, but that can be restructured into 90 minutes, which is what a lot of people are doing, because you can then go resell that, and you can sell it on DVD, and you can sell it on iTunes. And right. Paramount even has like their international TV distribution outlets that we can pump these series through now. So it sort of would release in the U.S. online with partners like Yahoo, and then we can go ahead and resell it in second and third windows because we have that much content.
Yeah, no, it sparked a question in me, which I ponder, because at Yahoo, we're doing things that are immersive. Our project with Tom Hanks, we had a party last night for it. Electric City could be 90 minutes or it could be short form. But I wonder, is that driven by the economics of it? So you can resell it. And is that compromising the story? And keeping with the topic of the panel, you know, is it possible to tell a story that's both episodic and narrative in an immersive way? Or are you're trying to, you know, meet two masters? Do you know what I'm saying?
I think you totally hit on something, which is one of the things that we all struggle with is there's really two influences at work. There's consumption habits of, you know, what consumers want and how they want to get it. And then there's these economic and business sort of economies of scale, you know, and sort of traditional ways of trying to package and sell what we do. And you end up backing into a model that tries to satisfy both, I think. A lot of digital distributors are somewhat allergic right now to airing things as a full 90 minute, as a movie. Mm-hmm. So they like to have these these essentially films broken into, you know, 9, 10, 12 episodes over the course of 80 or 90 minutes. And the reason why 80 or 90 minutes becomes important is because that's the threshold to sell something internationally or into a film package, an output deal, or something of that nature. And without that, then it's incumbent upon the distributor to be able to finance the piece of content 100%. That then leads to, are they deficit financing that content? Are they using advertising to offset it? And is there enough advertising to offset the full cost of doing something like that? So all those questions just continue to feed into this emerging model. One of the things that I've found pretty interesting and I didn't expect is the degree to which habitual viewing habits online still are really important, and where you see projects getting a lot of traction is people knowing that at 5 o'clock on Friday there's going to be a new episode of whoever you're following on YouTube, for example, and that the YouTube channels and personalities that have a tendency to do the best post in a very consistent pattern. And if they don't post something, you know, they let people know they didn't do it this week, they'll be back next week, and they just need to be very consistent with their word. And if the people are inconsistent, generally don't do well, which has always been sort of antithetical to what I thought was going to happen, which is you put a lot of stuff on, that's really about marketing to it. But part of the marketing and social media marketing of content speaks to having some continued relationship with your audience, which is fed not only by the content that you distribute, but by the communication in and around that content, that dialogue, or that which is really in essence becoming a new form of marketing.
I was going to ask you, taking the TV model, I mean, is there anything that we can learn from that? Because it's true, we are at Yahoo experimenting with, you know, every Friday, a new episode of our Morgan Spurlock show, because, you know, as you said, we found people like that. If there's a regularity to it, in the same way I know Sunday nights, you know, my new Showtime shows are available. So do you think that's something we can, is that just human behavior? No, wanting to have something to expect?
I think it is. I mean, I think the
parenting
sort of, I think it goes to sort of the, you know, creating an expectation and satisfying the expectation, sort of simple, you know, reward behavior. I don't think people watch it all immediately at that time, but I think the fact that they know it's there means they know to go to it within 12 hours, 24, 36 hours, because you still see the large amount of views coming, you know, within the first week. The other point that we all, I think, have to deal with is the digital economics are such right now that there's not enough upside for the big studios to really play in this space. So Paramount will, you know, get in business and back something digitally that Ben Stiller's doing, because Ben Stiller's a really important piece of talent to him. But if it was a producer who is known for doing digital work, probably not going to get behind them to that degree because they're in the business of trying to make $100 million enterprises, not $1 million in profit. Yeah. So there's still this huge gap, and the funding has to come from the distributors or the brands ultimately. So you're still meeting a lot of different masters when ultimately the ultimate master is the consumer.
Right, and I do think we're out of pace a little bit right now in that consumer behavior, consumer consumption, too many consumers in that word, in that sentence. Consumer consumption, audience consumption of online content is outpacing advertising dollars.
Right. I mean, the crazy thing is, if you look at the numbers of a lot of online content, even these YouTube channels that are basically pro-am, professional, you know, I hate that distinction because what's a professional, what's an amateur if consumers enjoying it, but basically people operating outside of the traditional system, funding their own content, putting it up on YouTube and being a network partner and getting a rev share. Over the course of 5 to 7 days, number of these people are getting 4 to 5 million views on a specific piece of content, generally short form. Mm-hmm. And if you look at that demographic, so let's say men 18 to 24, 4 million, 5 million views over the course of 5, 7 days, if you look at TV ratings, which now look at 5 days out, 7 days out, and DVR usage, the YouTube numbers are eclipsing TV numbers mm-hmm. in a huge way. I mean, mm-hmm. we have a channel called Smosh, and those guys regularly, you know, will outpace most of what's on MTV, most of what's on, you know, Adult Swim or other networks that go after a young adult audience. Mm-hmm. But from a perception standpoint, because no one's really looking at views in the aggregate, they're still reporting views as TV views or as box office views or as digital views. Mm-hmm. The whole marketplace hasn't sort of come to terms with what consumers really are consuming.
Yeah, no, I agree. And on that point, monetization and brands, because this is another topic that I wanted to hit on with this group. While the brand dollars haven't, you know, caught up yet with the consumer behavior, they're definitely an important part of this ecosystem. I think we'd all agree. You know, brands are having a huge stake in underwriting original video content online. How do you play with brands? Because it's unique. I think you all have some unique aspects of how you do it. And talk a little bit about how to ensure that a brand doesn't dilute the storytelling or maybe enhances the storytelling, in that I think, you know, traditional wisdom would be, well, if a brand's driving something, it's going to be like advertainment. And I guess I'd start with you, Larry, because Vugaroo's unique in that you're financing your own projects and it's incredibly story driven and creatively driven. So how do you fit brands into that equation?
Well, the most important way to prevent a brand from eclipsing storytelling is to have your own financing and have a real point of view on the storytelling and a priority around creative, which I think everybody on this panel has and I think is witnessed
exactly
by the stuff
right.
they do.
I should get an applause.
I'm getting applause from the panel. You know, that's when you really made it. So that's important. I think there are brands that fit really well into stories, and there are brands that are jammed in, and then there are stories that are jammed in around brands, and they're very obvious. I mean, there was a web series where the whole plot of the episode was that the kitty litter didn't smell.
I love that!
Yeah.
It was breakthrough work.
Yeah, so you have that. I also think there's a distinction between scripted and unscripted or lifestyle content. I feel like the panel here mostly is, and Yahoo does both, and Alloy does both actually as well, but Mike and I are more focused on the scripted side where it's a little harder to fully integrate a brand in a major way. And at Vugaroo, we've integrated brands into our projects in a bunch of different ways. I mean, we won an award for integrating Skype into Back on Tops. It was just very organic to the show. So it can work. I think in unscripted or lifestyle content, it works really well. And I think the audience is really happy and accepting of that. So if you're doing a travel show and you've integrated the Chevy Volt or you've integrated Marriott hotels, and that doesn't bother anybody because it really fits into to the creative. And I think people also accept that the brands are the reason why that content is there. But when you go to see Transformers, you're expecting that that thing is not there because an advertiser paid for it, but because Paramount paid to make it. And I think that's there's a bit of a difference on the scripted side as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one thing to keep in mind is that you raised a great point, which is the majority of branded content online is against sort of reality or lifestyle programming. It's rarely against narrative because the brands, with few exceptions, aren't directly underwriting the content. So it's difficult to go out to a brand and say, I have this great idea, will you finance it? What they finance is the media buy against the network, whether it's Yahoo or Alloy or anyone else. And they pay a premium for having content become somewhat customized for them. So in the reality informational space, it's at a low enough cost basis, they can sort of make that work. But scripted becomes a much bigger endeavor on everyone's part. And so scripted, I think, has lagged content efforts online as compared to reality or lifestyle, because in order to create scripted programming, you really needed the distributors to come around and start to take some risk on, which has been a little more recent. In the past, the distributors would say they're doing something, and there were all these companies that were digital networks, and they said we're going out with this great big show, and they wouldn't do it unless they got a sponsor, so it was like a flashing green light, and they didn't do it, and the sponsors cried bullshit and knew that none of this was really going to happen. But now, with Yahoo's efforts and a couple other companies that are saying, we're making this, we're doing this, and you can either sponsor it or someone else will, it starts to replicate more of a TV model, and that's where there started to become some traction.
I mean, and Mike, have you had any instances in which you're producing content that is brand funded and have creative conflicts, or
we've had massive creative conflicts and have had projects fall apart left and right because of advertisers.
Did you do the kitty litter?
Did not do the kitty litter. We passed on that one. It's tough for us, you know, especially as a company. We have such crazy quality control over script, especially, and Ben Stiller is involved in every little tiny aspect of everything, in the best way, because, you know, we are having Paramount deficit finance things, and we are sort of coming to advertisers later. But I think part of the idea is bringing the talent that we bring to the table to online. It's already sort of like everyone's migrating over, but if we bring these people over, it's like, yeah, Ben Stiller's doing this web series. Like, yeah, advertisers are going to want to be associated with that no matter what it is. That's like the lucky thing for us. It's not the case for everyone. If, like you said, if I didn't have Ben Stiller as my producing partner, I would not have a studio deal at Paramount. That's the reality of it, but it's hopefully going to help everyone because it's going to start bringing the advertisers and bringing the money.
And hopefully, I would say, advertisers are going to treat your company in terms of a production different than they're going to treat a company like ours or one of the producers on our projects. Meaning advertisers, you know, look at talent like a Ben Stiller, and they're going to be wary about giving notes directly.
It's the best thing ever.
Versus, you know, like,
you're afraid.
We're doing something, you know, around Fashion Week, and there's, you know, the agency and the branded entertainment division and the brand director, they're all giving notes that are as crazy, have no fundamental understanding of the production process whatsoever. And so that becomes really difficult to manage. And for, you know, talent that has other opportunities like TV or film, that's not a real attractive situation, and a lot of them will push back and say, you know, fuck this, I'm not doing it. But, you know, for some emerging talent or for companies that really need to reach some scale, you sort of put up with it to get it done. And what advertisers don't seem to totally understand is that talent, that works in TV and movies that are coming in the digital space aren't doing it for the money. They're doing it for a degree of creative freedom
right.
and ability to do things quickly. And if that's going to get bogged down in a process of getting notes directly from advertisers, forget about it.
Right.
Yeah, and I mean, one thing we're trying to do, and we are new at this, so we're still learning, is to make content outside of the actual story that we're telling. So it's, if a brand's coming on, we can cut a teaser and put their, you know, brand at the beginning of it. We can do things and sell things to the brand that can surround our series, but exactly, we're not taking notes from sponsors, and we're doing product integration in the same way that we would do in movies, where it's like, you know, we have a TiVo in Tropic Thunder or something. It's just things that are natural to the story or to a joke, or if there's something that comes along that's, and we're not close-minded about it, if there's something that comes along that we can make funny, you know, then we'll do it. I mean, if it's something that we're having fun with and can make comedy out of, we'll do mm-hmm. it. But it's, yeah, it's hard for us to just squeeze it in. And with the things
can
that
I
we
just
make,
add yeah. one thing here?
Yep.
I mean, that's a great point, because the one thing that advertisers do allow and digital does allow is to extend an experience out into other layers. So if you have a primary window of something being distributed either digitally or on TV, what advertisers do like to do is sponsor additional content. And I think creators have gone really good at creating additional content that extends the mythology out of, mm-hmm. of stories, creates backstories, allows other characters to get a moment in the spotlight, or to create additional material, not so much DVD extras, but really an extension in a non-linear way of the storytelling. But for real fans, it's an added sort of bonus of sorts, and for creators, it gives creators a chance not to have to play in such a limited, theatrical or film format. It allows them a lot more freedom to do what they want to do.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great point. And when we were talking about the linear sort of nature of television, this digital space allows that freedom to have just what I call a 3D experience, a holistic 360-degree experience, where you are watching perhaps a linear narrative piece of video, but you can watch ancillary video, you can read, you can follow the characters on Twitter. And you can have a whole experience around a piece of content you couldn't have before, where you start to be able to follow trails and backstories that otherwise would be left unexplored. I think that's a great, great point. What I was actually going to ask, thinking about comedy, thinking about Ben and his voice and what Jordan said about a lot of talent coming to this space to have freedom, which I've definitely found at Yahoo, that the talent we've interacted with, Tom Hanks, a couple others that aren't announced yet, Ben, want to have their voice on sort of unfettered, and we want to facilitate that. We've said we're not going to try to kill you with notes and control your creative process. This is your sandbox. This is your playpen. But do you think web audiences, it's harder to bullshit them, that that there is a desire for the content to just be more honest, whether it is lifestyle content that's really about travel, or it's a piece of comedy that, to be funny needs to be a bit risque? Do you think there's a difference there, or that's true across mediums? Did I stump Jordan?
No, I it's funny because I couldn't remember if I had this conversation on this panel already or if it was over coffee, but I think it was over coffee. But someone was talking about, YouTube talent and younger creators, and this idea of professional versus amateur, quality versus not quality. And what's interesting on YouTube, and we have a number of clients who do a lot of comedy work on YouTube, is some of the people really score the actual sort of technical filmmaking or the editing is pretty poor, but there's an authenticity and credibility to those performers that is what people connects to. So I think I think that consumers are not as hung up about the perfection of the video and the audio and the cutting as they are about, is this person for real or not, and are they authentic and credible across all forms of communication that you have with them, whether it's video or whether it's their Facebook or Twitter or anything else that they're doing. And so I think that type of celebrities that you're seeing right now that really are starting to resonate for the most part are celebrities that have some consistency across what is this blurring line between sort of their personal lives and sort of public lives.
And when you say celebrity, you mean YouTube celebrities as well as
YouTube celebrities, reality right. celebrities, comics, filmmakers. I mean, I feel like in the past, when you used to say celebrity, it was a big movie star, you know, like a, you know, Tom Cruise, but like, you know, someone like Ben's a good example because he operates in a lot of different mediums, but there's a consistency there that I think people look at and say, I get his comedic point of view, and he sort of executes that in a way mm-hmm. that, again, has authenticity to it. And I think that openness is increasingly important for consumers.
How important are celebrities in this space? And I use that word in the way you were saying, movie stars, people with traction in other media. Do you think that they're, I mean, Larry, when you're looking at talent to put in your programming, is that a consideration? And what's driving that? The creative, the economics, their ability to sell this?
A big celebrity will help market a particular property. I mean, what's interesting, though, is, you know, you look at Matt Damon's social footprint versus Kim Kardashian, right? I mean, who's going to get you more attention purely online? Just in terms of, like, Twitter followers and Facebook fans and all that kind of stuff. So I think there are celebrities who are huge movie stars and who can get on all the big talk shows, and there's a lot of value there. There are no names in the movie and television space who have millions and millions of followers. And then there are some actors kind of in the middle. And Ben's one. I mean, they've built a really big social media footprint. I feel like those are the most valuable. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are economics that drive it. The budgets for digital content are still much smaller than for television and film. I just think it's a dynamic market. It's changing. That's a fancy way to say things are changing. Say it's a dynamic market.
I didn't see it coming.
Yeah. It's just, I like to, it's like cable TV. In the early days of cable, people got cable to get a better signal, and then it was just reruns of movies. You know, HBO was boxing and movie reruns, and nobody knew what AMC was, and FX was just sort of coming around, and Stars and Showtime were just packaged with HBO, and there wasn't really that much interesting stuff there. And then MTV was doing, like, remote control game shows and things like that, rerunning music videos. And then over time, I'll spare you the 15-year evolution, but
thank
if you,
you
fast forward to today,
nope.
tonight over drinks, I can tell you the whole thing. But if you fast forward to today, it's, in my opinion, the best shows are on cable. Breaking Bad, Rescue Me, Game of Thrones, Sopranos.
My fave, Homeland.
Homeland. I mean, so now we talk about
Chloe and Lamar. That show's awesome.
Everyone's entitled to his or her own preferences, but
best equals also most watched.
Yeah, but that's actually a good point. It's split. There's massive popularity behind what I call lifestyle or unscripted, like all the stuff on Bravo, which has huge audiences, and Bravo also didn't really exist 10 years ago in its current incarnation. And then on the other end, there are channels that do scripted. So AMC came out of nowhere, and now they have three hit shows, and FX is strong, and Showtime was an interesting one. You know, 6 years ago, mm-hmm. if HBO passed on your show, you'd be like, Showtime, and now it's a great place to be. So I think the internet will follow a similar trend. There'll be huge personalities that are popular, and there'll be lifestyle content that's popular, and then I think you're going to see the some of the best, coolest, most creative, different narrative content on the internet. With the added benefit of if you work with Yahoo, it's going to get out worldwide to millions and millions of people, which doesn't really even happen in cable TV. In fact, again, like, you know, if you don't have that channel on your package, or if you are in a market where you don't get, you know, AMC or whatever, like, people will watch it on a Netflix. So I think it brings with it all the benefits of ubiquity and worldwide distribution.
And we also get to pick up people that were like, on a place like Yahoo, there are people going there already. You don't get those kind of viewers on a show. You go to the show, you know. It's not like people are just there. So it's great to just have these audiences that are there.
Yeah, I mean, we are in a unique position, and I know it every day, and know that I have a great job because I have a platform that has, you know, 170 million people every month coming through Yahoo.com, and we're able to market and program and promote to them. But in a world where increasingly, and that's amazing, we are able to build franchises that have numbers that outpace cable. But in a world where increasingly there's more and more content, more and more choices, more and more available for a consumer across platforms, Netflix, Hulu, Hulu Plus, your cable, Yahoo, you know, all of it. How important, and Mike, I was going to throw this to you at first, but all of you, please. How important is social, first, I'd want to ask, because you've all mentioned it a little bit here, and I mean, it's clearly a big part of the equation now. How important is social media and other forms of marketing and distribution? I mean, if you don't have a Yahoo, mm-hmm. what other levers are you really interested in pulling? And social, I think, for comedy is really interesting, too.
Yeah, and especially with, like, Twitter, I mean, comedians are becoming these like massive celebrities that wouldn't have followings otherwise. People like Rob Delaney, who just like write jokes, 10, 20, 30 jokes a day, and just become these superstar writers. And for someone like Ben, he didn't really, not that he didn't use the internet, but he didn't really know what the internet was before like 3 years ago. And we got him on Facebook and on Twitter, and he does it himself. I mean, he at first wasn't sure about it, but he wants his Twitter to be real and honest, so it's not jokes and it's not videos from me and it's not bullshit. It's him rooting for the Jets or whatever he's doing. It's sort of like that's his way that he can connect with fans, because it's there for him and it's there, and he can use it when he wants, and he can look and respond to people when he wants, and he does get interactive with people. It's interesting, but it's sort of at his will, and he has now probably a couple million followers on each Facebook and Twitter, just, you know, from racking it up. But, you know, we're not relying on that to market. We don't force Ben to tweet for our movies. I don't think that matters that much. I mean, we're expecting people to come to the content, and we don't put it on Ben to be the guy who's marketing it. You know, it's just not the way we do it. And, you know, for something like, we did this thing a couple of years ago. You know, Ben wanted to build a school in Haiti, and we did a whole charity campaign, viral videos. This is pre-earthquake Haiti. And we did a whole campaign, and we just spoofed Live Strong, so we just made Stiller Strong. And we just did like a whole fake Twitter thing with Lance, where Lance Armstrong pretended he was suing us, and we sold headbands instead of wristbands. And we just threw like stupid videos that I made with him on a flip camera. We like sold like $300,000 worth of headbands, and it was crazy. And then we did this, going back to the social media stuff, we did this thing called the Night of 140 Tweets that was at the UCB Theater, which seats like as many people as are here, 100 people. But we had 140 performers come through, and it was like Ben Stiller, Ashton Kutcher, Demi Moore, Will Ferrell, Weird Al, Sarah Silverman, like crazy big Twitter people. And what we did was we made a show, a half-hour show, that just each person came out and read one tweet. So it was like you have these crazy people, and Sarah Silverman's on stage for 20 seconds. And the way we wanted to do that was we were like, okay, well, we have 100 people in the room. We can donate that money. But how can we sell this? So we sold it through iTunes. We sold it through Amazon. And we asked everyone to tweet about it. And just through that, we were number one on iTunes TV for a week, just with this like stupid thing where people read tweets. It's really vulgar, and you could probably still get it on Amazon. And all the money goes to Haiti. But the social stuff is important. It's important to me too, just as a user. I mean, you know, addicted to Instagram. So follow me on Instagram if you don't have it, at Mike Rosenstein. And it's just, you know, it's how the people who we want to see the shows are connecting. So if for our shows and our characters, like you said, like we're going to do that with our series and have sort of our stars that are in it, you know, do what they want. But we, again, don't rely on that. And we, especially if we have Paramount and Yahoo backing a series, we sort of rely on their marketing abilities. But again, they'll market, you know, even Paramount, if they spend money, it'll be through social, it'll be through Facebook and Twitter.
Right.
You know, that's sort of, that's their digital marketing.
Right, yeah, no, we view it as an essential platform. I mean, Facebook and Twitter and all the other social media components are where people are now. I mean, 65 to 70% of all people are using these platforms now, you know, including Ben Stiller as of 3 years ago. Do you guys have thoughts on social or, you know, we've actually now almost filled the time.
I think it's absolutely critical.
Yeah.
And, you know, to the earlier conversation about celebrities, you see a lot of celebrities, big celebrities, do stuff on digital, and because they don't have a social footprint, it just, no one comes to it.
Right.
You know, so celebrity doesn't guarantee views on digital, and if all you're tweeting is, come watch this, come watch this, come watch this,
it's not real.
No one's responding to that, too. There has to be a real dialogue there.
Gets to that authenticity point. You know, people want to see that you are a real person and would rather probably hear Ben tweet about the Jets than come see my next movie. Or then when he does tweet a picture from his premiere, that's in essence marketing his movie, but it's personal.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. There or, because I was going to say at this point, you know, we've got some time for Q&A, and if there's something we could touch on that interests you guys. I don't know, do we have a mic or should I just have people? I don't know if the room's small enough, people can just shout out and I can repeat the question if people can't hear.
I've been doing like short films and internet sketches for a couple years now, and I think a lot about production value. And you see you guys like you're talking about like the pro-am feel, like Smosh and Brain W and a bunch of guys that are high up on YouTube, that the production value is good enough, you know? And then you see other things like Funny or Die that have these celebrities in it. They have high, nice production values. Looks like something you'd see on TV. Do you feel like those will continue to coexist in a way, or do you think one will eventually win out over the other? Or because right now I feel like you guys kind of touched on this a little bit. The advertising dollars are more in the celebrities or more kind of draw that way. So do you feel like one will eventually win out, or do you think it will always be kind of this, these pro-am guys have a ton of views and doing their thing, and then the celebrities are kind of like doing other things, or how do you guys feel about that?
There will always be both.
Before Mike answers, just real quick, could the room hear that? Everybody good? Okay. Sorry.
No, I mean, the question was, will there always be better production value and shittier production value? I think that there will always be both. Most of the stuff that I watch on YouTube is because it's found or it's weird or it's like, I mean, what's the stats on how many things are uploaded to YouTube? Yeah. It's like a billion hours a day. It's like, you know, there's that stuff will always exist, And it's great, and that's what the internet's about.
You know, one of the big conundrums for talent that is really prolific on YouTube is if they want to migrate over into film or TV, that means they can't continue to do what they do. And once they stop, you really start to see the views go down. So they sort of are in this, hamster wheel a little bit. Mm-hmm. A lot of them like that, though, because the rev share is enough. They're not living in Hollywood, you know, necessarily, or New York, and they make a decent living, a really decent living, you know, through that. And the more views they get and the rev share splits get to be what it is, and advertisers do start to, they usually get approached by advertisers by being part of a network. So a lot of these YouTube personalities are part of networks like ours and other networks, and that helps them monetize as well.
It'll be interesting to see how long those last, I think. You know, that you've got Seinfeld on for 10 seasons, but is Freddie and maybe around for, you know, is this audience more fickle? Can he sustain that as he gets older? It'll be interesting to watch and see these big franchises.
I agree.
Yes.
Hi, I'm a professor of graphics, and I've been struggling with the university system where, you know, I'm a filmmaker, I'm a web designer, I'm this, I'm that when you guys are looking for either content producers or for people that work at your various studios, are you looking more for some people that are more breadth focused and have like a lot of different skills, or people that are deep and are really focused on one direction?
Can I ask you some questions as a graphics producer? I mean, as a graphics professor, what does that mean?
Graphic design, but we do everything. So print, web, video, everything.
Yeah.
That's been my focus, and sometimes I get pressure to be like, just focus on web, or just focus on this. And I think that seems to be the wrong direction, considering.
You have a great question. I mean, we are looking specifically for people who can do a lot of different jobs. It's the way that it works because, you know, in Hollywood, like the job of a director and the job of a writer and the job of, I mean, all these things are really expensive. So for something like Burning Love, we had Ken Marino, who's the star of it, who you probably know from The State and Party Down and whatever, Children's Hospital. But basically, he came on with this idea. His wife wrote it with him. He directed it. He's producing it with us. He's starring in it. So it's like you have these people who can do everything. And I've done another series where the same guy directed it and wrote it and edited it. And it's like you have to have these sort of multi hyphenates to do these projects is sort of the best way, because we're also making things that are a singular vision, a singular voice. Like, that's the way it works best online. So the things that we're doing, you kind of need that one brain, and then we're there to sort of support it creatively and make it happen.
Yeah, I would say producer, editor, shooters are really valuable, and a lot of students coming out of college are getting that experience, but I don't think it's because the college is pushing them. I think it's because they're just picking it up on their own. Mm-hmm. I'm a thing to remember about universities. I'm a UT grad. I sit on the college board, and universities are like traditional media companies. They're just built in silos. They're very institutionalized, and they have a very difficult time sort of adapting. And UT's doing a pretty good job of it within certain departments, but you have a better sense of it, and ideally younger people have a better sense of where it's going. You're going to be ahead of the universities.
I would just add, I think for something like marketing, it is a specific skill, marketing online, marketing in traditional media, but we run into this a lot. Someone will say, I'm a web producer. I have a show for you. That it's not relevant. You know, it's really independent film is now one and the same with independent production online, if it's narrative. I mean, if you're a personality and you're a YouTuber and it's you, that's a little different. That's more like independent radio, you know, the next Howard Stern or the next Adam Carolla or something like that. But for narrative storytelling, you know, I think eventually the universities will realize that the film program should be exactly the same as the producing for digital program. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and all these guys coming out of film school, like, they can learn everything and they know everything. So there are certain people who I've come across who are just like geniuses, and they're just locking themselves in their room all day and shooting and editing and producing and doing effects and all this. Like, there's these two guys. I would encourage you to go to their website. They're called fatalfarm.com. They're geniuses. And they're two guys who are just like, they didn't even go to film school for graphics. And if you look at their stuff, it's like over the top insane, because they just learned it themselves. And that's sort of where the technology's at. And those are the people who are going to emerge and really... those are the people we want to work with as sort of the next generation.
You, and then I'll go. Okay. Yes.
You are making a feature film for a $10 to $5 million budget. You end up putting it in Netflix and the Apple, and it's your job to go out on Twitter and Facebook to promote it. So after spending 5 years of making a movie and $5 million, you're spending more time promoting it. Meanwhile, the Netflix and the iTunes and the Comcast get rich, and you get nothing back. So it's become unsustainable. And I think we see that in the market. There are less and less
I mean, I can take a first crack. You know, it's interesting. I moderated a panel at Sundance. Yahoo sponsored the short film competition at Sundance. And as part of that, I moderated a panel. And the Sundance Institute which I think is fantastic. Carrie Putnam has started a filmmaker program around digital marketing and digital distribution, because filmmakers no longer just get to be filmmakers, to your point. They have to be social marketers, and they have to be distribution savvy, and they have to understand revenue streams. And I mean, it's a whole new ball game. And they're running a really interesting series of workshops for filmmakers so they can figure out how to actually not only get their film produced and distributed, but try to make some of their money back and also market it successfully. I do think you've pointed out something in the marketplace and inefficiency there, that, you know, those lower budget independent films have really, really shrunken. You're exactly right. In the same way that mid-level studio films have also shrunken. You know, we're seeing giant franchise tent poles like Pirates of the Caribbean that, you know, that somebody can spin six sequels off of, or you see, you know, comedies and things that are going to perform because they have big, you know, box office talent that's proven, like Ben. And I think out of that, I would hope, you will see people and or entities, you know, being opportunistic and creating new channels of distribution. I know at Yahoo we have talked about having an independent film channel eventually when we're farther down the road in our video platform. We're currently just distributing shorter form content, but we've definitely talked about playing in a feature world where we would enable filmmakers of all sorts to have a platform for distribution and monetize that effectively. I think the monetization piece is important and can't be underestimated. You know, I think we'd have to offer something that was competitive and, you know, better than an Apple or an iTunes. So that's all still very much in the works. Apple or Netflix. That's all very much in the works for us. But I do think you'll see other players out there getting into that space where they're picking up great content.
I would also add, you know, it used to be you did your independent film and you gave it off to a distributor and it was totally out of your hands and you were pretty much powerless to impact the success, whereas now you actually can impact the success of that and it's no longer you hand your baby off to someone. I have done some independent films and been in that position where they make a lot of promises up front and they don't deliver and there's really nothing you can do other than following it around to festivals or setting up your own screenings. And one of the reasons Vugaroo was started was to make these less expensive but great story-driven projects that are, as Aaron mentioned, that's fallen out of the studio marketplace. So, but just it's just history keeps repeating itself. When home video got really big, everybody shifted their whole way of looking at things. Say, okay, I can do a home video model, and the economics of that, and the distribution of that, and the participation on that, and all that are different. And this is just the same exact thing over again. It's just a lot of it's advertising driven. The numbers aren't there yet, but they're definitely growing. I mean, they're growing really fast. So it's just the home video business all over again, at least if you're an independent filmmaker. You just have to adjust. I think $10 million for a film is very, very, very hard to make that money back. Mm-hmm. As home video shrinks and without a theatrical component. So some of it is just reorienting the perspective to this new market, which is growing, but it's still pretty young.
Yeah. Yeah, I said you were next, and then we'll get this side of the house.
I talk a lot about the narrative, but I'm wondering if you guys have any insight as to how these new platforms are affecting documentary. Like, I mean, the National Film Board of Canada has been doing this really incredible, like, choose-your-own-adventure type documentaries, but they're not
Can the room hear these questions? Future of documentaries? Okay. Because we've been talking a lot about narratives.
I've also been producing a documentary at Red Hour for the past, like, 3 years. And my honest answer is it'll probably take us another year and we'll figure it out then because we don't know what the marketplace will look like then. But we knew going into it that our budget had to be so small and we had to shoot it so efficiently and digitally that we could make money back. So it's like not spending over $1 million in a documentary. That's sort of like, right, you can't do that if you want to make money. And we're talking to people like Morgan Spurlock and partnering with these people who are sort of trusted in that world. The documentary we've been doing is also, we're partnered with Fisher Stevens, who produced The Cove, Oscar-winning documentary. Ours is a little sillier than The Cove. It's about psychedelic acid trips, but it's like celebrities and comedians telling tripping stories, and we're going to reenact them and stuff. So that's what we're dealing with. So it's like, yeah, who's going to release that? I don't know. But we're not spending too much money that it's like a black sinkhole. It's like someone will want to see that.
And then I promise I'll get the back of the room. I've been biased toward the front.
I'm just really curious, because you know, it sounds like a lot of your financing comes from Paramount, a lot of yours comes from probably brands. And I'm curious, you know, from the equation, what are the budget thresholds that you guys are producing? I'm sure it's divergent on somewhat, but say, you know, you guys use the example of 10 to 12 episodes, netting 80, 90 minutes. What kind of numbers are you guys producing for?
I officially refrain from going into that. I mean, the content really does dictate, and I know it sounds like I'm being like that's just a pat answer, but honestly, it's one of the exciting things about this space. The budgets are all over the place, literally. It just truly depends on the type of content, the level of talent, the length of the content, the nature of it.
Yeah, I mean, there are some things that you can do for $1,000 a minute, and there are some things, like we're also producing a Zoolander animated series that's going to be like cable TV animation costs. It's insane how expensive that is compared to something that we can just shoot a single camera, you know, like with a, you know, human being. It's just, yeah, it's just...
I'll jump in. I think like on the 90-minute side for scripted, you're starting to see somewhere in the range of like $500,000 to $1.5 million on the high side. Mm-hmm. And so it's more $500,000 to $1 million. And then on the 22 minutes, 150, 250, right. 44 minutes, 250, 350. It's starting to come up, and there is starting to be some, I mean, there's a lot of different things all over the place. But for the first time, I mean, I couldn't have answered that question a year ago. But in the last year, there's enough distributors that are starting to put some money against it. It doesn't get you all the way there. So it does become some version of like a home video model or a traditional, you know, sort of international co-production film financing deal.
And when you're operating at those budget levels, are you generally operating with guild talent?
Yes. The question was about guild talent. It's not always guild across the board, so it'll be DGA almost always, WGA mostly, SAG-AFTRA mostly, Yahtzee's when it starts getting a little trickier.
Sure. Do you see pressure from IA at those budget levels?
At those budget levels, you know, what's happening is that the talent is getting so upset at their unions because they're the ones who want to create something, but the unions are withholding them, restricting. Now, I'm a DGA member, but we have a lot of our executives are WGA, DGA, but the frustration comes from certain restrictions don't facilitate that, and some guilds have been more accommodating and some aren't. And on almost every production, they're trying to figure it out, and our business affairs people are talking to the guilds and trying to move them certain ways. So it's pretty wild right now. But for the most part, you can get it done.
All right, back. Yes. back of the room.
So just to touch on something, Darren, that you said, you said it's not a linear world anymore. And you used the word immersive really briefly. Can you guys talk about a little bit the fact that most web content is underfunded linear content, yet...
I'll take it. I mean, I think that's the promise of that platform, and I think we're getting there. I think we have yet to see it fully realized. I'd agree with you. I think the beauty of that platform is that you can also screen a feature-length film on it, and I wouldn't say all web content in my mind is underfunded linear content. I mean, I love the punchiness of your question. I like it. I like to mix it up a little. I do think there's good stuff in its own right that's legitimate content that, you know, all of us take part in every day. But I absolutely agree with you. And where I want to go next is our experiences that are so multifaceted. I don't know if you all remember, Larry remembers the game that was around 2000, Majestic. You know, it was the fully immersive, you're getting faxes back when people still had faxes, you're getting phone calls. I think that's an amazing opportunity to tell a story where you can participate in that story at a bunch of different levels. And, you know, with any luck, we're going to play there at Yahoo, because I agree with you, and you're going to participate in the story. So you can capture some web video, and actually that's part of the story then. You know, it's what you're saying. It's participatory. You actually build, the audience builds the story and watches the story. You're consumer and creator. I absolutely think that we'll start to see more of that in the coming, you know, years. I know everybody's overused transmedia, but I think the true promise of transmedia is that there is a feature film or a television series, and there's a whole ancillary world going on. I think Jordan touched on it. There's a whole world going on that you can participate in, or you can just watch the show. So I agree with you, absolutely.
Yeah, we're not trying to be the whole internet. I mean, that device you describe, Facebook, is taking pretty full advantage of that, and it's not about creating linear, professionally produced content. So I think what this group is talking about is content online, but, you know, Instagram, Facebook, Foursquare, like, everyone in this room is probably doing all those things all the time on those, and those companies have become pretty valuable. So, you know, we're really describing content on the internet, and it's a part of the experience.
Right. It includes everything. Like, I think, you know, people will watch full movies on that, television shows, linear content, non-linear content. You know, I'm still waiting for a Hollywood studio. I know we have The Social Network, but to option some of the stories that come out of social media, you know, such as, you know, how you met your wife and those kind of things.
Yeah, I have a lot of friends who have met. I'm friends that are couples that have met on
I was wondering what word you were going to use.
On Twitter. And my brother's actually just met a girl through Instagram, which is really weird.
Wow. Meeting on Twitter would be, like, meeting on Twitter and Instagram, yeah.
And I know people who have met through even Turntable FM, which is, like, the weirdest.
I just say one other thing, which is some of this is technological. I mean, there's the big buzz, obviously, now is all around second screen and over-the-top solutions. And I think as this certain next generation TVs and devices really allows over-the-top, and there's going to be a lot of sort of synchronized services where you'd be watching something on one screen and your iPad, you know, or phone, you're going to have a lot of other information. Sports is sort of leading the way in that right now, but that'll extend out into narrative, and there'll be some really sloppy executions. There'll be some good ones.
All right. Yeah, it's interesting in the news space because, you know, Yahoo as a news provider has an editorial principle, you know, an obligation to be accurate and timely and trustworthy. And we've toyed with sort of that CNN eyewitness model. I think they've done that very, very well because I think today's consumer would rather have something, this is to the point about authentic and real and instant, than, you know, an AP story that's been vetted and takes 12 hours to come out. You know, people are already tweeting and reporting often on news and sports as it's happening. So I think, I don't know if I'm quite hitting your question, you know, we're trying to balance the need to be a legitimate source of news. And of course, we just partnered with ABC News. We have a massive strategic partnership with them where, you know, they produce a number of original web shows with their journalists. So Christiane Amanpour, Katie Couric, George Stephanopoulos, et cetera. Like, their whole roster is going to produce web content with us. On Screen, which is our video destination, we've absolutely thought about, because Screen, we're very intentionally developing a voice that's younger, that's edgier. Occupy Wall Street, it's interesting you mentioned that, because we thought, you know, how would Yahoo program that? Well, in news, we'd have George Stephanopoulos outside the tent city reporting from ABC. And on screen, we might have someone like you inside the tent city reporting from, you know, I'm at this drum circle, I'm getting stoned, whatever. But like, what's really happening inside? I don't even know you.
But you are stoned right now, right? Okay.
But you know, that stop projecting, Mike. But there will be, as long as I think it's framed in the right way, that's not been fully tapped. I mean, CNN does a good job. I don't know if that was quite your question.
Yeah, I understand the news.
Yeah. Right. Right. You know, I think certainly I can answer on the Yahoo part. I mean, we have a broad audience and want to serve them in everything they're interested in. So as we build out our platform, you know, someone's interested in a small village in Norway for sure. And we want to serve that. So there'll be places to tell those stories. You know, so I think there's room for that. There's absolutely room for that. It's about marketing it, programming it, making sure it finds the audience. I mean, that's one thing that differentiates us, a big differentiator from YouTube, is we're deeply involved in programming video, certainly across our content vertical. So if we took a piece of video on a village in Norway, we'd want to make sure we put that in a place where people are interested. Other, you know, there's search, of course. There's having it be keyed to search. But there's a programming piece too. So when we're developing things, we need to make sure that it's relevant and important to our audience and put it in context.
Sure, we actually did a series with Ben Stiller's parents, Jerry Stiller. Thank you.
they're
in their 80s, and our idea was like, let's just do this series that like is gonna hopefully merge the audiences, because they have all of these people that know them from the 70s that are, you know, 40 and above, and also they're just Jerry Stiller, you know, from Seinfeld and whatever. But we had them sitting on the couch talking about young topics. So the idea was get old people talking about younger things. And we got so many people to watch it. And it was also distributed on Yahoo.
Yeah.
That's how we thought of it. But we're not really thinking that way. We're just sort of looking for something that's funny and edgy. And, like, they have this real, real honest point of view, like we were talking about earlier. And they, you know, we just sat them down and let them do their thing. It was a mix. It was all of their old fans would come out of the woodworks, and it would be like people who wouldn't normally watch series would be like, oh my God, this is the best thing I've ever seen, because we loved them so much in the 70s. And then people like Ben would tweet about that one, but people would find it that are his audience. So it was really both audiences. It was the older people who don't normally watch stuff and the younger people who just wanted to see what Jerry Stiller was doing.
Mm-hmm. I think your point is spot on. At Vugaroo, we've done several comedy series that are coming out this year focused on an older female audience. Mm-hmm. They're huge online. The advertisers are all going after that group now. Like 5 years ago, it was all young males, and mm-hmm. it seems like a mm-hmm. sea change to moms,
yeah.
mm-hmm. older women. Yeah.
And no one's really catering to them. I mean, no one's really catering to them in terms of video content, you know, as much as they should be.
We're developing programming in Shine, our women's site, that's definitely aimed to 40 and over. And, you know, but we just did a live Bill Maher comedy special, and that audience was 45 plus and highly educated, a lot of them. Some were younger, but we attracted a large 45 plus audience that surprised us a little. Like, we had even 60 plus, you know, who like his smart, you know, kind of edgy comedy. So we're absolutely interested in serving that segment too, I think. I've been told I'm over time and need to
way over time is what we were told.
Yeah. way over time. So thank you very much. Really appreciate your attention and the questions.